It's All About Food with Karen Hartglass, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. And we have a really interesting show today. I love talking about food. Today, we're going to take a slightly different twist, although I think the conclusions will be very similar to what I'm usually talking about when it comes to diet and health and nutritional excellence. We're going to be talking about The Longevity Diet, a book that was co-authored by Brian Delaney and Lisa Walford. And the Longevity Diet is the subtitle, The Only Proven Way to Slow the Aging Process and Maintain Peak Vitality Through Calorie Restriction. Fewer calories, more life. And I've got Brian Delaney, one of the co-authors of the book, to talk about calorie restriction and the longevity diet for the next hour. Brian, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you. This is going to be a really interesting discussion, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So I've read your book, and it's pretty interesting. And like I was just saying in my introduction, I find there's a lot in this book that's very similar to at least the diet that I know I'm on and that we talk a lot about on this show, which is including whole foods, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds for so many reasons. And the one thing that we haven't really touched on is slowing the aging process.
Well, that's of course the focus of the book, as indicated by the title. But there are lots of other reasons, of course, for eating a diet that is vegetarian and even vegan that involve the health of the planet, which we don't touch on really in the book. I think we mentioned it parenthetically occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the focus of the book. But for us, this particular book has been focused on the effect on the individual of eating a diet like this. And the research in lab animals goes back actually almost a century, showing that reducing the amount of energy calories that you consume without also reducing vitamin and mineral intake below critical levels, because that would be malnutrition,
mm-hmm.
slows the aging process itself. And there are lots of ways to do that. It doesn't have to be vegetarian. It doesn't have to be based on any kind of whole grain or really it doesn't have to be vegetable-based at all, but that's by far the easiest way to do it, because if you tried to eat a diet like this using meats, it would be very difficult to find a kind of meat that was very non-fatty, didn't give you too much protein, which is another problem, and had the right balance of minerals and vitamins. So it turns out that it's not just good for the planet, but it's actually really good for the body itself, the
right.
individual, to eat
so here's the point I think we're going to be making over and over, but I think it's important to repeat so that people don't get confused, and that is, it is very possible, and I think we're going to find out very beneficial, to have a diet that's really minimal in calories, but so important that it's full of nutrients, all the nutrients that we need. This isn't a potato chip, 1,500 calories of potato chips. This is a certain minimum number of calories to sustain life, create
right.
energy and vitality, and support all of our bodily functions and our immune system.
Exactly, exactly. Taking someone who eats the way I did when I was much younger, basically 3,000 calories, mostly junk food, I wasn't going to be exactly, and reducing calories to 2,000 or 1,800 is actually not going to improve health. I mean, a 1,800-calorie diet of potato chips will make you less fat than a 3,000-calorie diet of
yeah.
potato chips, but you'd actually be worse off in a lot of ways, because if you eat enough potato chips, you'll get enough of certain minerals, not all of them, and certain vitamins. And if you reduce that, not only are you still eating the potato chips, but you're actually not getting enough of the minerals that you were getting on the 3,000 calories of potato chips. So it's both the 3,000 and the 1,500 or 1,800 calorie potato chip diets would be horrible, but they're horrible in different ways. If you're going to reduce your caloric intake at all, it really should be high quality food to make sure that you get the other essential nutrients than calories that the body needs. Absolutely essential.
Okay, so you've been on this diet for almost 20 years.
I guess I'm that old, yeah. I started when I was 29.
Well, about
18,
the book said, so.
Yeah.
Right. Now, this is something that we don't hear quite a bit of, or at least characterizing the diet in this way. So what was your introduction to this? What was your motivation?
Well, there's the introduction and the motivation, and those are two different things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very strange. I was in graduate school in California, and I got a really bad case of food poisoning.
Mm.
I was sitting on the beach in Mexico reading Heidegger's Sein und Zeit, I think it was, and I ate a bad burrito. I don't know what it was, but I got really, really ill, and it was the first time that I had ever been in a hospital, aside from when I was born, and it got me to think about my diet, because I really, really ate badly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that got me thinking about the diet simply because I had been ill, and I was sort of struck by the fact of my mortality, which I hadn't really thought about previously.
Mm.
So I did a lot of research in the medical library in California at UC San Diego, and that's when I came across the work of Roy Walford, who was the guy at UCLA who my co-author, who was the first researcher to advocate that humans could actually apply the principles that had been developed in the research with lab animals. So my motivation then became, once I learned about the research itself, was that this is clearly, according to the research, this is clearly a way that's much more effective than simply switching to vegetables. Switching to vegetables and eating less,
mm-hmm.
a bit less. And or maybe more than a bit less if you can deal with it, is the most effective way to improve health in general if all the research done in animals applies to humans, which there's every reason to believe that it does, and probably to slow the aging process significantly. Not you know, you're not going to live to be 300, but you probably can live if you start the diet early, stick to it fairly rigorously. It's likely that you can add another 10, 15, 20 years to your life. So that was then my initial motivation. And then the more I thought about food, the more I realized that eating a vegetarian diet is good for the environment, it's good for the planet. So there were lots of other additional reasons that came up later.
Yeah, we talk about them all the time.
I'm sure, yeah.
Well, it's just really interesting because this thing about slowing the aging process, I'm just surprised that this diet doesn't get more press, but I guess it comes down to people really like the easy way out, the pill, the plastic surgery. But the idea that inside and out we can really slow the aging process simply by what we eat is very compelling.
Well, it is, and it really has puzzled us. I'm speaking of Lisa and me, but also the Calorie Restriction Society International that I'm the president of, and we don't try to push anyone to start the diet, but we want to provide information about it and then
mm-hmm.
people can make their own choices. But it really puzzles us that there isn't more information about this. And I think there are two reasons. One is the one you mentioned, that people like eating, and they like eating to excess. You can
mm-hmm.
certainly enjoy eating and not eat to excess, but people like eating to excess, and that's perfectly understandable. You know, as Blake said, the road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom. There's a lot that's good about all kinds of excess, but most people don't like the notion of restriction
yes.
of their diet or any source of pleasure. But there's, I think, an additional reason why this diet hasn't caught on or hadn't caught on. It's beginning to catch on now a bit more, and that's that there weren't any studies, really direct experimental studies in humans,
mm-hmm.
and that made a lot of scientists and especially physicians skeptical, because people want the kind of ideal situation where you have started in 1850, where you had you know, a whole bunch of people, 1,000 people eating the way people normally eat, and another 1,000 age and sex, and et cetera, socioeconomic status matched controls eating this diet, all starting in 1850. And then 160 years later, we would then know with an extreme degree of certainty whether or not the diet worked. But we'll never have that kind of research data for any intervention or putative intervention into the aging process, because studies, the researchers would have to be in the intervention in order to see the research through. You could never get funding. So the research itself in humans is always going to be partial. But until the late 1990s, the only research in humans was relatively indirect. There was that in Okinawa, that's really the only place on the planet where, for cultural reasons, people have adopted a mild version of the longevity diet, or CR, as we call it, calorie restriction. And they have the highest rates of centenarians, which is one measure of the tendency of a population to reach old age, in the world. So we had that bit of data, which was tantalizing, but it still wasn't a direct experimental result. But then starting in the late 90s, we had short-term calorie restriction studies, where you have people who go on the diet for a few years, and you compare things that we believe are biomarkers of aging, like cholesterol levels, simple things that are cheap and easy to measure, fasting glucose levels. And the people who had been on the diet for a few years appeared to have aged less. So that has made the diet catch on a bit more. So we'll see how far it gets, but it still surprises me that you don't have millions and millions of people following the diet.
Well, I think there's something ingrained in us. Maybe it's in our DNA, or maybe it's just from our upbringing, from parents that have been through difficult times, the Depression, World War II, where food was scarce from time to time. And so now that a lot of us live in abundance, this idea of holding back is really difficult.
You know, I think you're right about that. There's something about the cultural history, and maybe even certainly at some level something in our genes as well, where as a species we wouldn't survive if we didn't eat enough. So it's a sex and food. These are the two things that it's very hard for people to say no to.
Right.
Whenever they're available.
Yep.
Both.
Get it.
People say tend to say yes. And I think that's a big part of it.
And the other part of it, you know, we're definitely a capitalistic consumer society, and when you talk about buying less of anything, you're not going to get the general market behind you in putting out commercials to support buying less food.
Well, exactly. It's not like an exercise program where there's stuff to buy to help you exercise, shoes, running gear, whatever. This is actually very cheap, and no money from it. Even the people who write books about it don't make much money from their books. It's amazing. There's really, you know, maybe a food scale. You know, there are things that would help, but there's really no way to make money from this diet, no obvious way. And speaking of making money from the diet, and the reason that people haven't caught on, is that there's something really fascinating about what's happening with the research now. The research into the effect of calorie restriction in humans and in laboratory animals is revealing details about how it works at the genetic level. And interestingly, and this makes perfect sense, and I actually applaud the research that's moving this direction, but interestingly, one of the things that has occurred to many of the researchers looking into this is that there has got to be a way to come up with a pill that does the exact same thing that diet does.
Right.
And there are now, I don't know how many, 5 or 6 pharmaceutical research companies who are trying to come up with what they're calling the CR mimetic, the pill that will do the same thing as the diet. And, you know, fine, more power to them. But for the time being, it looks like the diet really it might not slow aging dramatically, 30 or 40%, but it's looking extremely likely that it slows the aging process.
Well, I appreciate the science, and I love understanding why things work. I don't know how much I love the idea of people always looking for the quick fix. There's something deep down inside me that says, that never works.
Well, it's an interesting question. I think it could work, but for me, listen, we whatever information we have that's helping us develop a magic pill, the easy way out, that would works, then it will lead to the actual product in the form of the pill. So given that the research that's shedding light on how this works at a genetic level is both moving us in the direction of being able to develop a pill and confirming the notion that the diet itself works in humans, and if you want to live healthier and perhaps slow the aging process significantly, why not start the diet?
Yeah, well, one of the things that I like, I prefer the name the longevity diet versus the calorie restriction diet.
Yeah.
Probably from a marketing standpoint.
Yeah.
I always go for the positive description of something rather than the negative, and I don't like to think of my diet in particular or the diet that I'm promoting for anyone to think that they're going to be deprived or unsatisfied. And I mean, you do have some discussion from the different kinds of calorie restriction diets people are on, because it's really very flexible and there's a lot of variety. But some that are on a very severe calorie restriction diet will have feelings of hunger. I like to say that my diet is a diet of satisfaction, delicious foods, and not of deprivation. And at the same time, you get all, these great health benefits.
Exactly. That's a great way to look at it. I think the reason that calorie restriction is talked about so often is it's partly just because that's how scientists talk about it, because the scientists who started this work years ago, decades ago, weren't thinking that they would go on it themselves. But I agree completely. It should be the longevity diet or the longevity promoting diet or health promoting diet, because that's really what it's about. And the people who, I mean, there are some people who will just feel deprived no matter what form the restriction takes, and that's okay.
Yeah.
But the people who are willing to try this for long enough to adjust to it, even those who are on a fairly extreme. There are men who probably ate somewhere around 2,700 to 2,800 calories a day, who are eating 1,700 to 1,800 calories a day now, and that's a huge restriction. But they actually, if you choose food that are satisfying and filling, I mean, vegetables have a high volume to calorie ratio, so you can actually fill your stomach and not have consumed a lot of calories. Not only can you not feel restricted, but if you know how to cook, there are vegetarian dishes that are just as good as the fat-laden, cheese-laden classic French dishes.
Yes.
And if you know how to cook with vegetables, it can be delicious.
I totally agree. Brian, I want to take a quick break, and we're having a little problem with the sound, and so we'll get back to you in a few minutes. Just a quick break.
Okay, beautiful.
Thanks.
Listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
This is Glenn Ford. Join me and co-host Nellie Bailey every Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time for Black Agenda Radio, an hour of news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. That's Black Agenda Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Eric Davis, host of Expanding Mind. Join me and co-host Maja Daou each week as we explore the culture of consciousness, spirituality, neuroscience, media tech, and all manner of wonders and esoterica. Expanding Mind streams every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep your mind open.
Hello, I'm Mike Adams, the editor-in-chief and key writer of naturalnews.com and co-founder of the nonprofit site consumerwellness.org. I'll be starting a special segment on the Progressive Radio Network called The Health Ranger with Mike Adams. I'll be interviewing everyone from Dr. Jane Goodall to Suzanne Summers. Find out the latest in natural healing news and easy ways to live a healthier and more holistic lifestyle. So tune in on Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern every week on the Progressive Radio Network to hear The Health Ranger with Mike Adams.
This is John Rappaport inviting you to my new radio show on the Progressive Radio Network, which will air every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm an investigative reporter. I've spent 20 years researching health and medical fraud, deep politics. I'll have lots of very knowledgeable guests on the show who have information to share with you so that you can live a more healthy and informed life. Join me every Wednesday on PRN. That's 7 p.m. Eastern Time, the John Rappaport Show. See you then.
This is Mitchell J. Rabin to tell you that we have two new time slots every Monday and Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network. Join me as I interview and dialogue with the sung and unsung heroes of society with passion and with commitment. Scientists, healers, filmmakers, musicians, environmentalists, and gurus on Mondays, and a call-in show where you'll be the focus on Wednesdays. Again, Monday and Wednesday at 6 p.m., join Mitchell Rabin as together we create a better world.
To the Progressive Radio Network, celebrating 5 years of independent points of view.
Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. We're here live, and the number to call if you have questions is 1-888-874-4888. I also like to hear from you by email anytime during the show or during the week. You can email me at info@realmeals.org. info@realmeals.org. We're talking with Brian Delaney, the co-author of The Longevity Diet. And Brian?
Yes, hello.
You're there, loud and clear, very good. We were talking about the perception of people and this diet, and one of the things that I wanted to say is that I think people on the standard American diet today are probably on what we could call a calorie abuse diet.
It tends to be pretty extreme. I mean, I can say just looking at what people eat, I've been living in Europe mostly for the last 9+ years, and when I come back here and just look at what people eat, it's really astonishing how much they eat, and just that it's such bad quality food. It's astonishing that we're as healthy as we are, and we're not as healthy as we could be, but it's really calorie abuse. I think that's exactly the right word.
Yeah, so maybe we need to get that out to the public, this calorie abuse diet versus the longevity diet.
That would be a great way to frame the question, and especially talk about calorie abuse, or even, I mean, it's really self-abuse in a way, and to focus on the effect on health, not the way people look, because I think, I mean, one of the things that I've been sensitive to, and my co-author, Lisa Walford especially, who had eating disorders when she was younger, this just the message that people, especially young women, get, the contradictory messages. You know, some people saying they're too fat, other people saying they're too skinny.
Mm-hmm.
I think let's forget for the time being the question of how people look, just because I think there's too much of that, but just the effect on health, that's what's abusive. about eating these, you know, huge. I came into the airport yesterday, and these people eating these. I don't know. It wasn't even a sub. It was bigger than a sub. Some huge sandwich-like thing that yeah. I've never seen anywhere else outside of the U.S.
It's very obscene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So the thing about this diet, I think, for the most part, is that it really isn't. Well, from my point of view, it's not difficult. It's just perception that this sort of diet is really what we're naturally designed to eat.
It's definitely perception, and I agree it's what we're designed to eat to the extent that we are designed to live long, healthy lives as individuals. But I think getting back to this question about whether or not it's somewhere in our genes or possibly culture, but certainly genes, to eat a lot and possibly even to be abusive with calories. The tricky thing is that the question of what we as individuals are designed to eat and what we as a species are designed to eat, these are potentially completely different things. They're certainly at least slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at the way other species eat when they have unlimited access to food, and humans, when they have unlimited, we now see in the U.S. and increasingly in other countries, people eat a lot. And it makes sense from a species perspective, because what really matters, even in a species where social knowledge is important, and it's important for parents to live more than a few years after they have children, and even grandparents can be important, but even in a social species where grandparents and uncles and great uncles can be important, it for the species to survive, all that really matters is that you reproduce, stay alive long enough to teach your children what they need to know to function in the society, possibly your grandchildren, and then die. so in a way we have these amazing bodies that if we treat them well and don't abuse calories can live to be well over a century year old.
As I understood in your book, it's almost like tricking nature.
Well, precisely. It's almost like getting the individual to matter more than the species.
Mm-hmm.
So to speak, because what the species wants is for it wants to continue. It doesn't care about individuals dying of heart disease when they're in their late 40s, early 50s, as long as they've had as many kids as possible, and the kids have gotten old enough to learn the culture's language and learn the rituals. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what matters to the species. And in a way, it is exactly. It's tricking nature by saying, okay, nature. Yes, I may want to have children, but I'm actually more interested in my own individual survival, which, as it happens, now in a state of affairs where that has nothing to do, almost or very little to do with the state of affairs that was around when our bodies were, so to speak, being designed. The thinking about the long-term individual survival also happens to be thinking about the survival of the species as a whole, because the fact is, eating the way that people are starting to eat, especially in the U.S., is probably not going to be very good for the species, paradoxically. It was a long time ago, but now listening to the genes, the part of the genes that focus on the survival of the species, too much, people aren't even living long enough to raise their children in
mm-hmm.
some cases.
Yeah,
you know, men dying of heart attacks when they're 30.
Okay, so there's science involved, and okay, I'm personally not a supporter of animal experiments just from my own personal ethics, but there's certainly a lot of animal experimentation going on, and some of it does provide a lot of interesting and good information, and so some of your information comes from some astounding results on rats and monkeys.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could share some of the results that lead to your conclusion of slower aging.
It's really amazing. And let me also point out that I personally also have questions. I wouldn't say that I'm against animal research,
mm-hmm.
but I certainly have some questions about it. And it's particularly complicated here because if there's so much previous research that indicates that the diet, the longevity diet, let's call it now, in any species, pretty much, will slow the aging process. Is it actually hurting these animals, or is it helping them?
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? But anyway, the research that we have for decades, it was almost all rodents, mice or rats. And the standard experiment was you start at weaning, so very, very much younger than a human would want to start the diet at. And you have a group that eats as much as they want, and then you have a group that's restricted by, and they varied the amount. Sometimes it was only 20% compared to the control group, sometimes 30, sometimes 40, sometimes 50, sometimes 60.
Hmm.
And the more you restrict the intake of calories, as long as you're not also restricting the intake of essential nutrients like vitamins and minerals, the longer they live, up to, depending on the subspecies, up to somewhere between 50 and 60%. And then, obviously, you get frank starvation.
Mm-hmm.
The older the individual animal or human is when you start the diet, the less benefit you can expect, which makes sense, because whatever process is aging,
mm-hmm.
Is intervened in at a later phase. But what I found important, and what actually doesn't often get reported, is that as far as we now know, based on the animal studies, and to some degree based on these newer human studies, there isn't a threshold effect, which is important to point out, because the way this diet is presented, and it's called, especially when you call it the calorie restriction diet, people are afraid of this horrible, deprived life they have to live for 90 years. It makes people think that that you've got to radically change your diet, eat much, much less, in order for these longevity genes to sort of kick on. But it turns out, according to the animal studies mostly, that doesn't appear to be the case at all. It's basically any degree of reduction in the caloric intake will confer an anti-aging benefit. Of course, it's less if you're only reducing your caloric intake a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But the simple act of switching from junk food to a mostly vegetable-based diet will almost certainly result as an accidental side effect, without even counting calories or weighing yourself or anything, a reduction in caloric intake, simply because there's more volume per calorie. So, but the just to give one example of an amazing finding, they had it was at Cornell in the 50s. There was a study done that was it was the standard model. If you take half the animals and put them on CR at weaning, and the other half can eat whatever they want, and at an age, the longevity diet animals were old enough, I think, that all the control animals had died, and it was such a severe restriction that the female rodents weren't fertile. That happens, with human anorectics. They stop menstruating.
Mm-hmm.
But the researchers refed them a little bit. And this is the human equivalent of, 85 or 90. They refed them just a little bit, just gave them a little bit more to eat, and they started menstruating again and got pregnant at the rodent equivalent of 85 or 90 in humans.
Okay, so for all you Old Testament lovers, that's how Sarah must have conceived.
Exactly. So it really, when I read these things, I just thought, okay, there is an effect. And when you see it in flies and bees and spiders and fish, even without the human studies, it seems like this is an effect that isn't specific to any one species. This is something that goes up and down the evolutionary ladder, and that is now slowly being confirmed by the studies in humans. But it's very hard to argue that there won't be a reduction in the aging, at the rate of aging, in humans. The question really is it going to be really dramatic or not? But there will almost certainly be some reduction in the
rate. Well, what's unfortunate is there's so much information out there already, and some of it, a lot of it, gets misinterpreted and misused. I remember studies also done on rats over half a century ago where they were fed high amounts of protein, and they grew really fast. And so we interpreted this as eating more protein will grow faster, will grow bigger, and bigger and faster is better.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Bigger and faster isn't better. And, you know, nobody reported that these animals died sooner.
Exactly.
And so, you know, I think that is where people have jumped on this whole protein obsession craze. Like, that's the only thing they know about when it comes to nutrition is protein. I don't eat enough protein. Where are you getting your protein?
Well, especially, I mean, this is, as a vegetarian, this is something you probably hear all the time. And the fact is, it's actually really hard not to get enough protein.
Yes, it's really hard.
And the amount that we need is probably much less than what the government, or at least a little bit less than what the government is now. The government's recommendations are fairly low, which is good. But the amount that we need is probably even less than that.
And it's true. In the vegetarian world, that's like our most frequent question that we hear and the one that we like the least. But I've still heard plenty of omnivores and people, standard American diet eaters, whatever, when they're fatigued or something, they'll say something like, oh, I must need more protein.
Yeah, and
it's just
so crazy.
It's this big misunderstanding.
Yeah.
And come likely from a lot of misinterpretation of earlier science.
Absolutely, absolutely. That still somehow is out there in the ether, and we still believe it, even though it's been debunked many times over the course of many years. Yeah, no, it's amazing. And, I mean, then there are also these new, relatively newer studies showing that a protein, high-protein diet can help you lose weight. And all of that, and there's actually some evidence that's the case, at least in the short to medium term. But it doesn't mean that you'll be able to stay at that new weight level. It could be temporary. In many cases, it is. And more importantly, it doesn't mean that it's good for you.
No, you're mortgaging your organs.
Well, exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Now, one thing you stress in this book is the flexibility of this diet. So there are some people that believe you're supposed to get a certain percentage of fat and protein and carbohydrates.
Right.
One in mine is the 80-10-10, the Graham diet.
Yep.
But you're saying that that's not really important.
Exactly, because if you look at the research on diet and longevity, because the question came up, I think it was mostly in the 80s, about whether or not all of the past studies on the reduction in caloric intake and longevity missed the point, that it was actually a particular component of the diet, not the energy or the calorie content that mattered. So the whole bunch of studies were done varying the percentage of protein and fat and carbohydrates. And it turns out it doesn't make a difference to the longevity effect, not at all. As long as there is a reduction in the caloric content of the diet, and as long as the levels of all the other essential mineral nutrients like minerals, vitamins, essential fatty acids, and protein don't go below a certain critical level, there will be a longevity effect, and it really doesn't matter. These, I mean, there are essential fatty acids that, of course, we need, but fat in general, it doesn't have to be really low. It can even be relatively high fat. It's just that for a human who's not eating a synthetic diet, it would be difficult to have a very, very high-fat diet that also had enough vitamins and minerals.
And I can only hope that nutritionists start to move in this direction. And I don't think it's that difficult to eat healthfully, but the focus needs to be on nutrients for a minimal number of calories.
Exactly.
The most
exactly.
bang out of every calorie in terms of nutrition.
Exactly, exactly. And most nutritionists that I know are aware of that, but they don't think in those terms, partly because the people who come to them have other concerns. It's mostly, I think, I look fat. And so that's why people look for these magical formulas, lots of protein or lots of fat, somewhere something. I mean, the Atkins diet obviously was popular, popular.
Some of the people on this longevity diet, some of them are grazers. They eat small amounts of food all day long. Some you've written about eat three meals a day of the same dish.
Mm-hmm.
Other people skip breakfast. Some people stop eating after 6 or 7 p.m. There's a whole range, and some one person that you talked about fasts once a week.
Mm-hmm.
There's a wide range to suit individual styles.
Well, exactly. We try to follow the science in about the relationship between how you eat or the amount that you eat and longevity. And if you look at the science, it's not only that the proportion of fat or protein or carbohydrates doesn't matter, but the timing of the meals doesn't matter, and grazing versus eating one huge meal a day doesn't matter. And from an evolutionary standpoint, it would make sense that there wouldn't have to be a particular way of eating for the genes that control aging to be turned on, because if you think about the conditions under which this effect would have evolved, which would be some kind of famine. That's
mm-hmm.
the theory behind this. Some kind of famine requires that all the individuals in the particular group age more slowly, and then when the famine's over, then they can go back to the species side of the genetic need to reproduce, and they gain weight and have lots of children and die. But during the famine, obviously there will be times when you come across a stash of food and you eat more, much more than you were during the normal famine times, and then there's less food for the next week. And it would be bizarre if evolution worked in such a way that coming across a stash of food would completely nullify the longevity effect of the longer period of eating less.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also borne out by research. These extreme variations in the amount that the lapidar animals eat don't have an effect on the diet. Not all possible variations have been tested, but the ones that have been tested indicate that it just doesn't matter. So based on that notion, it was borne out by research and by this evolutionary theoretical way of looking at it. It seems pretty clear to us that there's lots of variety possible in the way that you can design the diet. And also this notion of cheating doesn't really apply. Because
cheating.
Cheating. I mean, because mm-hmm. there's not a list of good foods and a list of evil foods. If you eat a huge dinner one evening that maybe isn't as vegetable heavy as
mm-hmm.
the normal dinner that you would have, you just eat a tiny or maybe no breakfast the next day, and it would be the equivalent of, you know, 20,000 years ago, 50,000 years ago, being out in the savannah and you're in conditions of famine and you come across a stash of food and you eat it and then you eat less the next day. So
I agree with you. Even in the vegan world where everything is plant-based, there are more and more restaurants and prepared foods that not only are rich in flavor and variety, but some of them are very high in calories and very gourmet.
Right.
And so you have a choice, and you can choose to eat these foods all the time. And for those who are ethical vegans, they say, but it's vegan, I can have this. Or if you're on a health path, you choose, as a lifestyle, whole foods most of the time. And then
right.
for a special occasion, you can have something more extravagant.
Well,
and it's
exactly,
not cheating.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that it's when I see people who plan out their meals every day, and they, you know, they get invited to a party, they don't want to go because the wrong kind of food will be there. I mean, to me, I mean, people are different, and that might work for a lot of people. But to me, for my life, that would not be a good way to live. When there's a kind of inflexibility because of, you've got a list of evil foods and good foods, and you've got, you know, I can only eat 1,957.23 calories every day. I mean, that would be, I think, that kind of rigidity, I think, for me, would be insane. I think I would argue that there are a lot of people for whom it's insane and they don't realize it. So I think flexibility is good, very important.
I love the food that I eat. I am nuts about food, and what do I eat? I normally eat huge salads,
mm-hmm.
some vegetable soups, and when I say vegetable soup, there could be 100 different of them. There's not just one variety. And fruits, a small amount of grains, some legumes, some tofu, some tempeh, but it's mostly greens and salads, big ones, and they might be garnished with some raw nuts and seeds and some beans and grains, but in smaller amounts. And some nut butters that I mix with citrus to make a dressing. And great. I love these foods. And when I go on vacation, either in the United States or outside, I don't worry about gaining 5 or 10 pounds. I eat the same way. I come home, sometimes I even lose a little weight.
Interesting.
But, you know, I always want to stress to people that this type of eating is not deprivation. It's not dissatisfaction. Once your taste buds and your stomach kind of adjust, and it'll take more or less time for different people, it's a great lifestyle.
That's actually, I mean, one point there that I think is really important that really surprised me is that what counts as rich and delicious changes once you get used to different types of food. I don't need to have, I don't know, I don't even want to mention the things I used to eat, but, you know, I almost literally cannot say these things, but, you know, M&M's, I used to just this junk chocolate.
Oh, sure.
Eat. And I do eat chocolate now, but it's actually really good dark chocolate. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of it, but that would count as decadent splurging, or you know, a huge container of ice cream. But once you get used to eating in a different way, it's amazingly enough something like you were talking about a nut butter with citrus, something like that, just a little bit spread on toast or something, can be. Can feel
very
not just
luxurious.
Delicious, but really luxurious and really decadent.
Mm-hmm.
And but it's actually maybe you wouldn't want to eat it all the time because it's got a lot of fat, but it's actually generally good for you.
Right.
Certainly compared to the huge quantity of peanut M&Ms I used to eat.
So what is the pattern for you in terms of eating?
It's actually similar to your diet, although I'm not vegan, so I'll have some cheese with dinner. But and I skip lunch, which is, and I don't know if I'll always eat this way, but it made it possible for me to eat considerably less than what I otherwise would be eating without feeling really any hunger at all, except in the late afternoon, because that's when I haven't had anything since breakfast. And at that point, I am hungry, although I'm so busy I don't notice it. But that is where I'm really hungry. So I wake up and I have actually a very large bowl of a mixture of some kind of grain. I actually make my own cereal sometimes from kamut. But otherwise it might be something else. It might be oats with lots of different kinds of fruit. I try to eat a lot of blueberries, partly because they're good for you and partly because I just love the taste of them. And then I will have soy milk, but not every day. I will alternate that with my own soy milk alternative, which I make. This is actually not going to sound very palatable, but I actually have finally made it taste good. Because soybeans have a lot of fat. And, I mean, surprisingly, a huge amount of fat. So I didn't want to have soy every morning. And there's also some question about whether or not the phytochemicals are actually can mimic hormones like estrogen.
Right.
So I want to vary that with basically navy bean milk.
Navy bean milk.
Which doesn't sound, it sounds weird, but it's basically you do the same thing with navy beans that you do with soybeans. And you've got the milk alternative, but I add a little bit of ground up almonds and a few other things to make it less beany, basically.
Right.
And then sometimes fat-free yogurt. Let's see what else. Some raisins, apricots, a lot of fruit. So it's basically a huge, huge bowl of what would look like some variant of granola with fruit is how I would describe it to someone who didn't know vegetarian food. And that's really, it's big. I mean, it's 900 calories. It's a lot of food.
That's a lot. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's huge because this idea of breakfast like a king.
Lunch, I don't even think I could eat that much in one sitting.
Well, it's partly because I'm on this diet and I'm actually really eating less than what my body wants. When I wake up,
You're really hungry.
I am really hungry. Really hungry. So I have this huge, huge king sized bowl of fruit and various grains, almonds. And then I don't eat lunch. I drink a lot of green tea and a little bit of coffee. Although Sweden does not have good coffee, I should warn the listeners who may be traveling to Sweden.
What do people drink in Sweden?
Well, they drink coffee, but it's just
not... coffee.
It's just not good. It's just some kind of... I don't know where it comes from, but it's just... It's hard to get good coffee there. And then... so I don't eat lunch, and then for dinner I'll have... That actually varies quite a bit, but it sounds a lot like what you described. A lot of salads. But a lot of legume soups, you know, lentil or...
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you eat a lot of beans, but I have a lot of beans.
I do. Beans are very satisfying.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
they have a good mix of protein, carbohydrate. And
exactly.
Yeah, and they're just... And there are so many different kinds and so many different colors that there's really a lot of variety when you get into beans.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. People think, well, you know, there are navy beans and lentils and soybeans, but there are dozens and dozens and dozens of different kinds.
And I'm discovering more and more about them, depending on the type of cuisine you're in. For example, I live in New York City, the greatest city in the world, and we have...
I agree with that, by the way.
What?
I agree with that, by the way.
Yeah.
But continue.
And there are so many different cultures that live here, and so there are different areas with different markets. And there's one area in Queens where there's a big Hispanic community and a big Indian community. And so the beans in that store, things I've never seen before, sizes and shapes and colors of just a tremendous variety of beans. And something I haven't gotten into yet, which I want to, I've heard that there are heirloom legumes.
Wow.
And so they're bringing in from I don't know where, but beans that we haven't seen or beans that we don't normally grow, because unfortunately with our form of agriculture, we're going more towards monocropping and creating a limited amount of food rather than a huge variety. So there are all kinds of beans that we haven't even discovered yet or have been kind of hidden, I guess, in some other countries that are being brought to the forefront, heirloom legumes.
Amazing, amazing. This is another reason to live in New York, that things like that don't come to Stockholm. Not that I've seen, anyway.
Okay. Let's see. We have 5 minutes.
Are you kidding me? Wow.
Yeah.
Boy,
it's easy to talk about something you love.
For an hour, and it just zipped by, yeah.
Yeah. So what do we need to touch on in the last 5 minutes? Are there certain people that shouldn't practice this diet?
I'm very glad you brought that up. Normally I think of that myself, but I was sort of lost in the flow of our conversation. Yeah, obviously if you're pregnant or thinking about getting pregnant, it would be very, very unwise to try this for, I think, fairly obvious reasons. Although maybe a mild version of it wouldn't hurt. But
about eating the same healthy foods, but you just need more calories because you're supporting someone
else? That's a great way to put it. That's a great way to put it. You know, the other thing I think that we should stress is that anyone considering making any significant change to his or her diet or exercise regimen should probably see some kind of trusted, knowledgeable healthcare professional.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's always a wise choice. But anyway, pregnancy is a question mark. I think you have to eat more. But yeah, but you're right. It might not have to be. You certainly don't have to go from a longevity diet based vegetable heavy diet to potato chips when you're pregnant. That would be a bad idea.
Although some women might really want potato chips.
Yeah, exactly. But hopefully not just potato chips.
Mm-hmm.
Other things as well. And I think that people who aren't fully grown probably almost certainly don't want to try this diet for two reasons. One is that we don't really know. I mean, a mild version of it almost certainly wouldn't affect growth rate, but a more restricted version, certainly in animals, when they start at weaning, they end up smaller.
Right. Well,
so,
children, when they're exposed to a whole foods healthy diet, know when they've had enough to eat.
That's generally true. That's generally true.
But unfortunately, most kids are fed lots of other things in addition to what they should be eating, so it gets their calibration, I think, gets screwed up.
Exactly. And, you know, the one other thing about people who aren't adults is that there's a much greater risk for eating disorders among younger people, boys and girls, young men and young women. And I think that with a diet like this, if it's presented in the right way, it's not
it's not a weight loss diet. That's a consequence, of course, but that's not what it is. It's not restriction, and I have to remember to call it the longevity diet.
Yes, please.
Yeah, I mean, that's very, very important. But no matter how you present it, there are people who are at risk for eating disorders that any emphasis on rearranging one's diet could be risky to them. I think that, and that's one of the main reasons. It's really not about physical health, but almost psychological health for someone to talk to a healthcare professional. If it's a good healthcare professional, he or she will know, you know, well, maybe there's a little bit of a risk here of an obsession with food, and that would be something I would be cautious about with younger people.
We have a couple of minutes, and I just wanted to talk about, as fast as we can, athletes and exercising.
Great question, and unfortunately, we actually can't cover this in as much detail as I'd want to in the remaining time. But the research on animals shows that it's not a problem at all to exercise and be on even a fairly extreme version of this diet. But that obviously, if you're at the limit of how little energy you're taking in, you can't exercise more than a tiny bit, because that would push your energy use beyond the limit. But it's actually very hard for a human being who isn't locked up and being fed by some scientist to be on the diet at that limit. It's just because you'd just be too hungry.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's that much of a problem. One thing I would stress is that resistance training is probably more important for someone on this diet than for anyone else. It's actually true for everyone. But it's more important partly because you want to strengthen bones. Everyone does.
Okay, well, we've come to the end, and I think people want more information. They need to read this book, The Longevity Diet, and there's more information at your website, longevitydiet.info.
Exactly, and it was a pleasure speaking with you, it's a shame we don't have another 2 or 3 hours.
Well,
maybe
we'll talk again sometime soon.
Beautiful.
Okay, take care, Brian. Thank you so much.
Yeah, bye-bye.
You've been listening to me. I'm Karen Hartglass, and this is It's All About Food. Join me next week. I'll be talking with Dr. Neil Bernard, the Get Healthy, Go Vegan cookbook. Thanks for listening.